these days in New Orleans, as far as crowds see, you're mostly spotted as being the person that runs this open ears series. And how long has that been going on now?
About 3.5 years.
Okay.
It started in November of 07. Mm-hmm. Was the first one.
Is it doing what you want it to do? Is it still a... What do we got?
Yeah, I think it's still a viable entity. It's doing a lot of what I want it to do. It sort of started because there had become a vacuum in terms of places to do things that were less mainstream. Right after Katrina, there was a period of time where people were so happy to be open and have sound coming from their clubs that they would let you play anything. I mean, I played more gigs at Snug Harbor in the first couple of months right after Katrina than I think the rest of my life. They were crazy, weird stuff, beautiful, great. There's something on the stage, we're open. And that was fabulous. And but that kind of started to dry up. Mm-hmm. You know, when that next summer came and people realized, oh, you know, we have bills to pay. and booking got a little more conservative. And that sort of all coincided with King Bolden's getting shut down. Really, the reason the open ears started is because King Bolden's got shut down. Because Mario was doing relatively adventurous jazz on Tuesday nights. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, he liked me. And once a month, I would get a phone call from Mario that would say, hey, Jeff, what night this month would you like to have your band come play? So it was great. I had a band. We were working. We had a gig a month. I could write new tunes. It was cool. Well, then he got shut down. And the Dragon's Den, I think, was closed at the time. And there was just like all of the regular places where we had been making weird noises weren't there at this little point in time. And so I said, we need a place to make weird noises. I need to come up with a gig. Mm-hmm. And that thought turned into, well, if I can get something weekly, like I don't want a weekly gig, but, you know, then we could have other people play. And it made me think of the series up in Chicago at the Hungry Brain and the Hideout and the Empty Bottle before that.
And tell me about the going to Chicago thing. Well, let's get into the influence of that. You were going to Chicago, I remember.
For some time, have really enjoyed a lot of the music to come out of that scene. You know, the Vandermark Five stuff, and there's a really healthy scene of guys up there. And there's a fabulous trombone player named Jeb Bishop, who I had developed a little bit of a personal relationship with before Katrina. And when the storm came, I called him and said, "Hey, I want to, bring my band up and try to come up there and play." We actually initially met in some online trombone geek forums. Our first conversations were about the best ways to remove lacquer from old con trombones.
Okay.
I started this conversation, or somebody asked this question, so I had done some trombone lacquer removal, so I popped in with my answer, and I was like, wait a minute, Jeb Bishop, that's that guy that plays trombone with Vandermark. He's slamming.
Why would you want to remove the lacquer from trombone?
You really want me to go into it?
Yeah, why not?
Okay, so the old lacquer was often sprayed or painted on, and it didn't go on evenly. Uh-huh. So it would be thicker in some spots and thinner in other spots, so the bell would not resonate evenly because the lacquer was not on at an even thickness. So if you strip the lacquer off, the bell becomes more resonant. Some say it makes the instrument darker. Some say it makes the instrument brighter. I don't think anyone would argue that it doesn't make the instrument more resonant. And it's like a gear tweak thing to do to old horns.
And is it standard? The old guys would do it too? They were like all moving.
There's schools of thought that are like, oh, it's way better without the lacquer. Okay. And other schools of thought that, no, it doesn't make any difference. That's bullshit. To be honest, the older trombones that I've had, like I've got a couple of old con trombones that I took the lacquer off of, and they went from good to fabulous.
Okay, well, so...
I had a newer trombone, the Shires that I'm playing now, the first bell that I had with it. I took the lacquer off of it, didn't really make much difference. Mm-hmm. Now, if you ask Steve Shires, the guy that makes these trombones, he says his lacquer technology is much better, and that he's got a way that he puts lacquer on, and it's, like, pretty even. so that you don't get that same difference as with the older styles of lacquer.
And is the,
makes sense to me.
Is putting the lacquer on just cosmetic altogether?
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, the raw brass like gets funky looking pretty fast and ages and can get pitty. Like it can, it's protective as well as cosmetic.
Okay, it's protective to the brass.
Yeah.
Okay. So you met Jeb that way.
So we knew each other that way. He had come down here with the Bratzman Tentet. You know, so we had hung, talked shop, exchanged CDs, had lunch, whatever. And we're sort of developing a relationship beyond just like two musicians that knew each other. We were actually friends, you know, on an extra musical level. Anyway, so after the storm, I said, hey, man, can you help me book some gigs? Because I really need to play, and it was before there was much of anything going on here. And he said, yeah, well, when you come up with your band, maybe we can put together a thing with your band plus some guys from up here, kind of do a co-op thing, maybe record it, who knows. Well, it turned out none of my guys from here ended up going with me. Quinn Kirchner was playing drums in my band at the time, and he was from Chicago, ended up back. Anyway, I went up there, this band, the Lucky Sevens, came out of it. Josh Berman, who played cornet in the Lucky Sevens, is also one of the guys that runs the weekly Sunday night thing at the Hungry Brain. So the Open Ear series is very much based on what they do at the Hungry Brain. Like, when it started, when I realized, okay, I need a place to play where I don't have to argue with someone about booking whatever it is we want to play. I called Josh. Well, actually, I called Jesse Page at the Blue Nile. And pitched it to him, and he bit, and so I called Josh and said, okay, look, I got this thing hooked up. What are some mistakes that you guys made early on that I can avoid to make this thing work? And he sort of laid out some things that were important.
Like what?
Well, he said, first, you got to do it on a night where they weren't making any money anyway. He said, we started on Sunday nights at the Brain of Chicago. In this neighborhood bar, it's not really a music venue, except on Sunday nights. You know, there's a stage and stuff in there, but it's not known as a music venue. And it was like nothing, just a couple of neighborhood drinkers. Never anything on much going on Sunday. So whatever money the bar made was gravy. He says, you have to actually be there. They have to think you give a shit. If you don't show up, they're going to think, well, why, you know. If he doesn't even think it's worth coming to, what's the point?
Right.
And he said, the other thing you have to kind of get lucky on is you got to get a bartender that's into it. And they have a great bartender up there, this guy named Dan, who's the bartender at the Hungry Brain. And, well, we do here too. And but he said, we just got lucky. Dan showed up the first night and people played. And afterwards he said, I don't know what the hell y'all are doing, but this is cool. And so he said early on when it was light, Dan never complained about the no drinking jazz fans or having to work for the empty club because he liked the music. And the same thing happened here. We went through the first couple of weeks we had different bartenders, but the third week, I remember it was a duo show with Simon Lott and Justin Peak. And Ollie was the bartender, and Ollie came in and, you know, these guys are playing and we start talking and come to find out Ollie's a drummer, which I didn't know at the time. And he just freaked out. He's like, man, I don't know what they're doing, but this is great. Mm. And so now we've got this beautiful scene. Ollie likes the music. You know, there are nights when Ollie does very well on Tuesdays.
Yeah.
And there's other nights where not so much, but he doesn't complain about it. And the important thing is Jesse never has to hear the bartender complain, oh, these Tuesdays suck. The music's weird. Nobody drinks, blah, blah, blah. Because Ollie likes the music.
Right.
So now we're in this position where whatever monies the club is making is more than he would have made before because Tuesdays were dark.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't have to listen to the bartender gripe about it. Mm-hmm. And so it's a win-win.
How did you get familiar with the music in Chicago? Or why were you attracted to that?
Largely, my initial familiarity with it was through recordings. Just hearing about things and various online forums or, you know, even reading stuff in magazines. I think my first exposure to that was maybe after Vandermark won that got his MacArthur. You know, there's a big feature in Downbeat. And I was like, oh, what's this? And checked it out. And really liked the music. I mean, it's hard to describe a whole scene in these broad strokes, but I will go ahead and do it unadvisedly. You know, a lot of the stuff going on that in that scene is very aware of the jazz tradition or the free jazz tradition, but not necessarily encumbered by it.
Mm-hmm.
I think they largely feel free to explore whatever comes to them. But a lot of what they do is aware of the traditions coming from Ornette and Cecil Taylor and Albert Eiler. And those things all came out of the older jazz traditions. And I, you know, like that's the place that I come from aesthetically, is from a jazz place. Although if you said what I do now largely isn't jazz, I probably wouldn't argue with you.
You mean if somebody
if somebody said, "Oh, that's not jazz," I would probably say, "Yeah, okay, it's probably not, but it doesn't really matter." Oh. But I appreciate that tradition and like, and so a lot of the music that I first encountered from there seemed to be coming out of that tradition, and I just identified with it. I heard it and I liked it.
Okay, and let's talk about free jazz and tradition. Because you mentioned that it's in the free jazz tradition. I thought that's funny.
I mean, the stuff's old.
Vaguely paradoxical in it. I know, but that's why I'm wondering.
I mean, you know, the first Ornette record was in 1959.
Sure, absolutely. When he walked in the house, we were listening to Ornette over here. The thing was that what I'm interested in about that is that these people were very exploratory at that time. It was very... without concern for traditions, somewhat, until later on.
Well, so don't you think the habit of exploration can be a tradition?
Certainly. It's one of the oldest traditions in the world.
I use the word tradition, and possibly the word lineage would have been a better choice.
Okay. Yeah.
Because tradition does have these other implications of conservation. Mm-hmm. And really, lineage... is probably a better term. And that's the term that I use more often.
I mean, we should think, like, it's, you know, the record that was the second one or the first one, The Shape of Jazz, to come. So, the question is, are you part of the shape of jazz that came?
Yeah, probably. There's a great Wadada Leo Smith quote where he says, everything up to Ornette was jazz. And after Ornette, I don't like to use the word jazz. I call it creative music.
It's so funny, you know, because I when I talked to Rex Gregory the other day, and he was, which I have on one of the recordings, but I was telling him that you can read articles with Duke Ellington by the 40s. He's saying he doesn't play jazz. Well, this was mind-boggling for Rex in that conversation. He's really, what to describe the features of what you're doing? Yeah, very good. Very articulate about what that was and what, you know, what it is that he's doing now. And so you know, and just some food for thought, which is the interesting thing is they would ask, you know, they asked the same month over there in jazz publications, they asked Charlie Parker whether what he was doing was jazz, and he said no. And they asked Dizzy Gillespie, and he said yes.
I think a lot of these lineages are self-identified.
Okay.
I think there is some validity to the idea of, well, is that jazz? And the next question should be, does the person making it call it jazz?
Great. Okay.
I don't think that's the final answer, but I think that's definitely part of the equation. Mm-hmm. I mean, someone could say, okay, you played with Miles Davis, so no matter what you do, it's jazz. Even when Miles was doing things that probably weren't jazz. But the whole thing of defining what is and isn't is kind of pointless anyway.
Okay, just because you said there were features to what you were doing and there are features to something. I'm trying to come up with what the features are under the labels.
So the things that I heard in the Chicago thing that I really liked, I heard some respect for groove.
Okay.
Whether that groove be swing or more of a rock kind of thing. That scene doesn't so much do the funk thing like we do here, but they do a real like energy groove that comes from more of like a punk rock kind of aesthetic.
Funk being what? So to explain now these grooves. So clearly, this is interesting. So you're interested in some rhythmic content.
Yeah, the rhythmic thing is very important to me.
Okay, and so what was? So they were doing rock things, but not funk things.
Yeah, they're backbeat things. I described this in a really funny way for a European journalist once. Their backbeat things make you want to move more up and down instead of side to side.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I like it.
It's, you know, if you're at a punk rock show and it's like totally just, you know, when you move to that, you move up and down.
Uh-huh.
You bounce in place. Uh-huh. And if you go to a George Porter gig, you move kind of side to side or around in circles.
Uh-huh.
All right.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
You know, the motion that it all makes your body move, but it makes your body move in different ways.
Okay, I got you. Interesting. Okay, so this is great. Okay, so it was the rhythmic thing and the music and what else?
And the improvisatory nature of it.
Uh-huh. When you got there and met the musicians and all of that, let me come back to this. Where do you come from?
I grew up in Lafayette, Louisiana.
So you're
just a couple hours west of here, yeah.
And when did you start playing trombone?
10 years old, fifth grade band.
Fifth grade band. And
yeah.
Did you have a desire to play the trombone?
I had a desire to play music. My grandfather on my father's side was a musician, was a band leader in the Army, was a high school band director, was one of these guys that had like a bajillion instruments at his house whenever we would go to his house in the summer. You know, he had it wasn't a B3, but it was like, what's the like little church Hammond with the built-in speaker? Is it an A3? Anyway, he had this Hammond organ and a piano and like an upright bass and all kind of clarinets and saxophones and trumpets and trombones and all the shit back in a pile behind this curtain in his house. And I would go back and pull it out and say, Grandpa, play this. And he'd put it together and play something on it, you know? And I just thought that was so cool.
Wow.
So, like, as long as I can remember, I wanted to play music.
Mm-hmm.
So the summer before fifth grade came up. And it was funny because when I was little, I didn't take piano lessons or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Sung in the choir at church a little when I was a kid, but my voice changed way before everyone else's. And so that was very awkward. So I, like, ran off from that. I was like, I'm not dealing with that.
Because,
mm-hmm. you know, the third graders were singing, and I was singing an octave below them. And the teacher was like, well, somebody's too low. I was like, screw that. I'm not doing that anymore.
Uh-huh.
I did come back to some church singing later. But anyway, so the summer before fifth grade, I knew band was going to start. And we went to Grandpa's house, and he gave me this cornet and gave me a couple of lessons and hooked me up with the book. And I went home, and, man, I was shedding my long tones and playing the cornet like Grandpa had taught me. And we get to the first day of band class, and there's about 874,000 kids that want to play trumpet and like two kids that want to play trombone. Well, my band director, her name was Diane Robin. She was a very smart woman. She knew that my next door neighbor and best friend, Robert, who was a year older than me, played trombone.
Mm.
So I come up and she looks and she says, oh, you know, you've got kind of big lips. You have good chops for a trombone player. You know, and Robert could help you out. I think you should play trombone, not trumpet. So I went home and said, hey, Mom, I'm not playing trumpet. I'm going to play trombone. And she said, but we have a free trumpet, you know. And my grandfather lived in San Antonio, so it wasn't like, oh, let's just go trade this for the trombone he has. So we went and bought a trombone. But, you know, sometimes the most fortuitous things in your life seem like accidents.
Mm-hmm.
But I've since realized I'm a trombone player. I'm not a trumpet player.
Mm-hmm. And, so that was fifth grade, and then what? Did you have a trombone teacher?
It was mostly just the school band thing. Through, like, I took a couple of lessons in junior high. Started playing a little bit of piano. We finally got a piano in our house, like in seventh grade.
I'm confused how you learned to play a trombone without a trombone teacher, even early on. How do you play in a band without knowing?
Well, because in band class they teach you. They go through each section and show them how to do the thing.
How to do
you
a
know?
Couple of tricks on the instrument that'll make it playable. That's good. Okay.
Yeah, it's a slow, arduous process that becomes very paper-based at that point. I mean, if I were designing beginning music ed classes, I would do it very differently than it was done to me. Mm-hmm. Although it ultimately worked out. But
so you feel like you were impeded by the system that they taught you?
Not in terms of doing what you needed to do in the school band, but in terms of ultimately being a creative musician that values the information I get from my ears as much as the information I get from my eyes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had to unlearn some stuff. Mm-hmm. Or relearn some new stuff.